Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. PFAs, or forever chemicals as they're known, are the manufactured chemicals found in familiar brands like Gore-Tex and Teflon. While they may be convenient for their non-stick properties, scientists are connecting the chemicals to various health problems, especially among children. And now a new study has revealed PFAs are found in some different children's garments. Laurel Shader is a senior scientist at the Silver Spring Institute based near Boston and the senior author of the new study. Laurel, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann.
Let's start with a little bit of a primer, why PFAs are bad for us.
Sure. So PFAS chemicals have been linked to a wide range of harmful health effects. These range from elevated cholesterol, effects on the thyroid, kidney, and liver, and at high levels of exposure, they've been linked to cancer as well. Of particular note, PFAS chemicals have been linked to effects on the immune system, particularly decreased vaccine effectiveness in young kids. So this definitely raises concerns in communities with high PFAS exposures about any potential links to COVID susceptibility.
So that's the pronunciation, PFAS.
Right. So PFAS, or per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, is the name of this broad family of these forever chemicals. Over 9,000 individual chemical structures fall under this broad heading. So yeah, we say PFAS.
And they call them forever chemicals because they break down, but they never go away. They could be also called everywhere chemicals.
They're both forever and everywhere chemicals. As part of their chemistry, they have many carbon-fluorine bonds. And so these are some of the strongest chemical bonds that are out there. So these chemical structures, either in their entirety or at least parts of their chemical structures, basically never break down under regular conditions.
So part of the everywhere thing is that they're in almost everything we use, but they're also everywhere in the air. They're still out there. You don't have to be able to see them.
That's right. And they've been found in the far corners of the globe, even in polar bear blood near the Arctic, and in virtually every American who's had their blood tested for PFAS.
Are there any legislative regulations for PFAS?
So there's been a lot of activity actually at the state level. So many states have put in place restrictions on PFAS in drinking water. There are a number of adopted or pending bills that would restrict PFAS in food packaging and consumer products and firefighting foams. At the federal level, there's been less activity. There are agreements by manufacturers to phase out certain PFAS chemicals, what we call the legacy or long chain PFAS. So certain PFAS are no longer manufactured in the U.S., but in their place are other PFAS chemicals, which raise some of the same health concerns. EPA right now currently has a guideline or a non-enforceable value for just two PFAS compounds in drinking water, and they're currently considering establishing a drinking water standard.
What are the particular dangers for children who are exposed to PFAS? And of course, children are exposed to them all the time, just like the rest of us are anyway.
Absolutely. So a couple of concerns specific to children. One is that young children's bodies are developing. So in general, they tend to be more sensitive to the harmful effects of chemicals. Another concern is that kids are exposed even before they're born. Unfortunately, PFAS get passed along from mothers during pregnancy and through breastfeeding. So babies are born with PFAS already in their blood. So they're exposed, they're sensitive, and they also may be more exposed to PFAS in our everyday environments at home. If your kids are like my kids, when they were younger, they spent a lot of time on the floor, they put their hands in their mouth a lot, so they can be exposed more readily to PFAS that are in our home environments.
And you mentioned that a lot of children's products with PFAS were labeled non-toxic or green. Can you talk about what products we're finding this in?
Sure. So our recent study focused on measuring PFAS levels in certain types of products that children and teens are likely to come into frequent contact with. So we focused specifically on clothing, bedding, and home furnishings. And we were particularly interested in whether information on product labels could help parents figure out which products were most likely to contain PFAS. You typically don't see PFAS showing up on product labels. We did learn that products that were labeled as water or stain resistant were more likely to contain these chemicals, and particularly the ones that said stain resistant. They were even more likely than ones that just said water resistant. As you just said, we didn't necessarily see the products that had an eco-friendly term like non-toxic or green on the label were less likely to contain PFAS. And even certain third-party certifications, those were also not necessarily indicative of PFAS-free products. Now, green certifications are really helpful for consumers to avoid other types of chemicals of concern like pesticides, but they haven't really caught up to the challenges of PFAS yet.
Well, how do parents know what products are safe?
That's a great question, and I wish parents didn't have to worry about this kind of question. I think to the extent possible, if parents can avoid products that are water and stain resistant, that makes, that's likely to reduce their exposures to PFAS. For some items like mattress protectors, you want them to be waterproof. So if you can read the label and look for products that might be waterproof with a different type of additive, maybe a rubber barrier in the middle of the mattress protector. And you might be able to call the manufacturer or ask the store. But unfortunately, a lot of times consumers are in the dark about what are the chemicals that are in the products that they're purchasing for their families.
I guess this is something, because children are developing, this is something we're not really going to understand fully for decades, right?
That's right. There's still a lot of research underway to fully understand the range of health effects that can be caused by PFAS exposures. And again, because there are 9,000 different compounds in this family, most of the research we've done have only looked at a handful of those compounds. So it would be an impossible task to establish the toxicity of each one individually. And that's why many scientists and regulators are pushing for restrictions on PFAS as a class, rather than trying to tackle this issue one chemical at a time.
Yeah, because, I mean, no matter what, as you said, they've been found everywhere. They've been found in the deepest depths of the oceans, the highest peaks in the world. Nobody is free from it. They get their nickname for their long degradation time, which is never ending. Is there any way to cleanse the world of PFAS?
I wish there were. I wish I could say yes. At this point, the priority has really been on putting in place water treatment systems in areas where there are high levels of contamination of drinking water supplies in order to protect people's health who are consumers of that drinking water. And there are some efforts to remediate the most contaminated sites, for instance, near industrial facilities where these chemicals are manufactured, or sites where groundwater has been contaminated by certain firefighting foams. But as far as trying to rein them back in, once these chemicals are out in the environment, given their high persistence, there's really no way to clean up the whole environment. In Europe, there's a push to think about very persistent and very mobile chemicals as chemicals of high concern for exactly this reason. Once they're out in the environment, if we do discover they raise concerns, there's really no way to rein them back in. So I hope that we can learn the lesson and not repeat the same mistake in the future.
You know, we talked about everybody's exposed to them now, but are some people more exposed than others given where they live?
Absolutely. So some people can be more exposed because their drinking water supply has been contaminated. Here in Massachusetts, our State Department of Environmental Protection put in place a drinking water standard in 2020. So our water supplies are now testing for PFAS chemicals, and they're showing up in a number of communities, both here in Massachusetts, and they've been discovered all across the country. So communities with water contamination are definitely vulnerable. Some people can be exposed through their work. Firefighters, people who work with these chemicals in their everyday jobs can also be exposed. And then in areas where there's environmental contamination, there's also concerns about other environmental pathways of exposure. For instance, people who rely heavily on local fish as a source of food for their families.
You're with the Silent Spring Institute researching the environment and women's health. Is there any particular dangers for women?
So we are focused pretty heavily on understanding environmental links to breast cancer and other concerns related to women's health. PFAS definitely are on our radar screen because of evidence that PFAS chemicals, and one specific PFAS chemical in particular, can impair mammary gland development in laboratory studies. And to us, this is a red flag that these could be chemicals that raise breast cancer risk. It's very difficult to make links between exposures to environmental chemicals and diseases like breast cancer. We think that exposures that occur in the womb and during early life are really critical for increasing women's risk. And it's really difficult to try to go back and recreate that in an adult woman who might find out she has breast cancer. So definitely these chemicals raise concerns because of their potential links to breast cancer, but there's still a lot that we don't know on that front.
And are they particularly protected by anti-tort laws? I mean, as the exposure is, we gain more understanding. We already know they're dangerous. What? We just live with it? And
There was a lawsuit in West Virginia, and if you've seen the film Dark Waters or the documentary The Devil We Know, if you haven't seen them, I definitely recommend them.
Yep.
This was about a community in West Virginia where there was extensive contamination from a DuPont plant that manufactured Teflon, and there was a successful lawsuit raised by the community there that led to a very extensive health study that provided a lot of information that we currently have about the toxicity of PFAS chemicals. And it also provided for medical monitoring of residents in the community. Medical monitoring is the idea that if you've had high PFAS exposures, you know you're at elevated risk for certain health outcomes. And so medical monitoring puts your doctor on alert and provides testing for markers of diseases that you might have increased risk for. So that's a pretty notable lawsuit. There are other lawsuits underway, say by water suppliers that are having to spend millions of dollars to filter out these chemicals. But in large part, it's the companies that have profited from the manufacture of these chemicals are not have not yet really had to pay for a lot of the cleanup. Right now, as I said, there's no current drinking water standards. There's also no listing of PFAS as hazardous chemicals under the Superfund law. So typically for other types of contaminants that are longer term concerns for us, if there are chemicals that are found at a site, the polluter is responsible for paying for that cleanup. It's likely that certain PFAS chemicals will in the future be listed as hazardous chemicals. And then we may see more pressure on the polluters to pay for the PFAS cleanup.
But we know it takes a long time to get on that list, the Superfund list.
It's a long list. And so far, EPA really has just had their eye on a couple of PFAS chemicals, the ones that show up most frequently. And in some communities where they're impacted by manufacturers making newer PFAS chemicals, those might not be the specific ones of concern. So it is a very long process, like you said.
Laurel Shader, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It was nice to talk with you, Ann. Thank you.
Laurel Shader is a senior scientist at the Silent Spring Institute and the senior author of a new study that reveals these so-called forever chemicals. You find them in Gore-Tex and Teflon. They're found in some different children's garments, and children face increased dangers from these chemicals. We'll have a link to the study on our website at wosu.org/allsides. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Some people just can't say no, and that can have a deleterious effect on their mental health. Vanessa Bonds is an associate professor of organizational behavior at Cornell University, and she's the author of the 2021 book, You Have More Influence Than You Think. Vanessa Bonds, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So this has kind of come up particularly. People feel a lot of pressure these days to do this, do that, get out, go there, go here. Where is that's kind of pandemic induced inability to say no, right?
I think that's definitely part of it. I think it's been exacerbated to some extent by the pandemic. You know, we had this just sudden blurring of our worlds where we just lost all sense of boundaries. And now coming out of the pandemic and feeling like the world is opening up, we feel like we want to sort of take advantage of everything there is to offer, but we've lost the ability to sort of set boundaries to some extent. Yeah.
No, go ahead. I mean, you know, tell me what you mean by setting boundaries and why that, what that has to do with saying no.
Yeah. So setting boundaries in terms of, you know, sort of prioritizing the ways we want to spend our time. One of the problems with the pandemic is that it sort of blurred our work life. Many of us, you know, moved to working from home, and it blurred our work life with our home life. And we were constantly connected to work and constantly, you know, getting these little dings throughout the day with requests, work requests. You know, we might have some personal requests at the same time, you know, kids tugging on us, asking for things as well. And we kind of got used to just constantly being on and sort of reestablishing kind of our own time and time that we can prioritize and not just constantly respond to that ding on that phone or on that computer is part of setting boundaries. And so part of that is when people do ask us for things, you know, learning how to say no to some extent and carve out our own sort of priorities, or say yes mindfully is the way I kind of like to think about it. But also taking time to turn off all of that connectivity at times, so we're not constantly being barraged with these requests.
Right. And a lot of us, well, there's that side of it. For those of us who didn't work from home, but went home as refuge during the pandemic, a lot of us became homebodies during that time. We changed a little bit, but we didn't necessarily get better at saying no, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think because many of us kind of closed ourselves in, as things open up, you know, we first of all are a little tepid trying to go back into the world. You know, it feels a little overwhelming. But at the same time, we have all these opportunities that were shut off from us for so long. And research shows that actually we kind of exaggerate this feeling of FOMO, this fear of missing out, that we tend to think that, you know, if we don't take advantage of things, that we're missing out on what everybody else is doing. If we don't take advantage of things, that, you know, we're never going to have that opportunity again. And so I think a lot of us are at this place where we feel a little hesitant to kind of make our re-entry into the world. And yet we're really worried about missing out on, you know, this possible opening to be able to reconnect, kind of get back to our lives. And so we're kind of wrestling with that tension.
What's the issue with always saying yes, just doing it?
Yeah, you know, if we say yes to every opportunity that comes our way and every request people make of us, we can end up overextending ourselves. So that can ultimately lead to burnout because we simply end up with too much on our plate. It also means that we can have less time and energy to focus on the things we actually care about or truly enjoy doing because we have all these other things sapping our resources that we just agreed to because we couldn't say no.
What's the harshness bias? Where does that come from?
So the harshness bias is this tendency we have to assume that people are going to judge us more harshly than they actually end up doing. So it turns out that people are actually much more generous when judging other people than we tend to assume when we think about how we're going to be judged. So if we make a faux pas or trip or make a mistake, we assume everybody noticed it. And everybody, you know, has now concluded that we're an idiot or, you know, just a bad person, or we kind of exaggerate this in our minds. And so it's related to this idea because we think if I say no to this person, you know, they're going to think I'm a terrible friend. They're going to think, you know, I have no interest in going out or whatever the question might be. When in fact, people often aren't judging us to that extreme level that we assume that they are.
And that is part of what propels us to do things we're not really interested in doing or we don't have the bandwidth to do.
That's certainly part of it. So we tend to feel kind of anxious and uncomfortable about the prospect of saying no. We worry about offending the other person, damaging the relationship, looking bad or unhelpful. And for all these reasons, the research actually shows that we tend to default to just agreeing to things to avoid all of this kind of imagined negativity and this imagined damage to the relationship. But in fact, kind of that social risk that we're perceiving is exaggerated because of this harshness bias.
What do you recommend? I mean, is it a good thing to just say, hey, I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but I'm just not up to it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so I tend to think about, as I said earlier, saying yes mindfully. So it's not just, you know, coming up with ways to say no, which is an important part of saying yes mindfully, but it's about taking the time to really think about whether you want to agree to this thing. And so I'd say step one is taking your time, actually taking the time you need to decide whether you want to do something. Often we feel put on the spot. We feel this urgency that people expect us to respond much more quickly than they actually do expect us to respond. And if we take our time and decide, nope, this isn't something I want to do, then we can come up with the words to say that. And it could be, you know, thank you so much. So you're conveying this warmth. You're showing that it's not about you. It's not about me not caring about our relationship. You know, thank you so much, but I just, you know, can't do this right now. Maybe in the future, I could leave the door open. Finding ways that basically say, we're still good. You're still good. You know, I'm happy to help in the future or do something with you in the future. So all those kinds of concerns are mitigated, but also still making it clear that actually this is a no in this case.
How can we get better? So when it comes, you say we, you know, as far as the harshness bias goes, we're thinking that people are more judgmental and you know, that than they really are. But it's a two-way street. Can we be better at hearing no? And can we be less judgmental about what other people are making about choices about what they do with their time?
Absolutely. I think in general, we tend to, on both sides, kind of exaggerate the meaning of no. When we ask for something, we hear a no, we tend to think that that means, you know, no forever. And, you know, I'm never going to agree to anything in the future. And in fact, most people don't mean that. Usually people decide just based on the circumstances, this just doesn't work for me right now. And I think the less we can sort of take offense to hearing no and make it okay for people to say no, the better it is for everybody.
People who have a hard time saying no tend to be people pleasers, right? Generally.
That is part of it. There, you know, is a personality trait called agreeableness. So that just tends to be, you know, people in general who are high on agreeableness tend to say yes more frequently. But in fact, it turns out that most people are at heart agreeable at a default. So there's a classic study that Ellen Langer of Harvard did with people waiting in line for the copier. And she had a research assistant ask to cut in line of these people. And she had a few different conditions in the study, but in one, they gave a nonsensical reason for needing to cut in line. They said, can I please cut in line because I need to make some copies? Well, everyone in line needed to make copies, so this really wasn't an explanation that made any sense. But people didn't really notice that it didn't make sense. They were just processing this request mindlessly. And when they did, their automatic response tended to be to just let the people in, so just to agree. And that's over 90% of people in that study just let the people cut in line as their sort of automatic default response. And so as much as there might be sort of individual differences, certain people are people pleasers or more agreeable, in fact, it seems like most people's default is to be agreeable.
Okay, interesting. And is it just a matter of mental health that we're talking about here, or can being too much of a people pleaser, too much of a yes man or whatever you want to call it, physically hurt us?
Well, if it causes burnout indeed has been associated with several, physiological stress responses that are related to it, because we become overwhelmed and we detach from the things that we used to enjoy and the things that we used to care about. So there could certainly be this sort of overwhelmed element as well.
And then the mental health, I wanted to talk to you about signs that people might be not be very good at reading the signs in themselves. Can you give us some ideas about what that looks like and how to respond to yourself and what you're feeling?
Yeah, definitely feelings of feeling overwhelmed, feeling exhausted, and sort of detaching from things that you used to find interesting or used to find challenging and you just kind of don't care anymore. Those are all some of the signs of burnout, which could be a sign of sort of being overwhelmed and just taking on too much in general.
And then conversely, how do you know if you're wanting to say no is not a good sign about your mental health? So maybe you're avoiding things. Maybe it's a function of depression. It's not necessarily a good thing. I mean, that it would have been better to get out and be with people.
Yeah, it's definitely possible in some cases, you know, that this kind of sense of I just don't want to get out there. I just don't find anything enjoyable anymore about spending time with friends or things that I used to enjoy. It's definitely possible that could be a sign of something else going on for sure.
And what do you do then? I mean, see it for what it is, talk to somebody.
Yeah, I would probably talk to a clinical psychologist in that case.
Vanessa Bonds, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
Vanessa Bonds is an associate professor of organizational behavior at Cornell University. Her 2021 book is titled, You Have More Influence Than You Think. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When word broke that a 6-year-old boy finished the Flying Pig Marathon in Cincinnati earlier this month, the outcry from the running community was heard loud and clear. Dr. Ashley Pence is the medical director for pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Dr. Pence, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I guess let's just start generally about what appropriate exercise is for children.
Yeah. So obviously we want our kids to be physically active every day. The recommendations from the AAP is that children should be engaged in about 60 minutes of moderately vigorous activity every day. So moderately vigorous activity is where their heart rate is up, but they're still able to speak in full sentences. And they're still able to, you know, cool themselves down. And that is the recommendation for them to be active every day. We know that it builds lifelong health for them to be active every day.
What is the physiology of a child that renders super vigorous marathon-like exercise or physical exertion questionable?
The kids are very different than adults. I think people like to look at children and go, oh, they're just little adults, but they're really not. Their muscles are different than us. Their ligaments are different. Their bones are different. They still have growth plates. They don't typically have as many sweat glands as adults do. So they're not able to cool themselves down as efficiently as adults are able to. And so when a child is engaged in very vigorous activity for very long periods of time, they can hurt themselves. We've seen as pediatricians an increase in overuse injuries over the past few years as children become engaged in more intense year-long sports. So we've seen that. Kids can become overheated very quickly if they're not hydrating before, during, and after their physical activity. These are things that you have to worry about. And if they sustain an overuse injury very young in life, then their ability to continue playing sports and being athletic for their entire lives is going to be limited.
You know, I've thought a lot about gymnastics and, you know, it's been in the news a lot over the last few years because of the abuse issues among trainers. But I've also kind of thought a lot about how the fact that a lot of these, particularly women, well, I suppose men too, start very young in life doing this.
They do. And again, I think that's, you know, again, as a pediatrician, I tell parents all the time, like, don't make your child a single sport child early in life. Like, let them do other things. Let them play baseball. Let them do gymnastics. Let them do dance. Just because this gives their body and their muscles different ways to move. So they're not always set in one way of movement, gives them more flexibility, gives them more endurance and different things. And that way you're less prone to this, to these overuse injuries. I think, you know, we've seen some terrible injuries in some of these gymnastic competitions or in any competitions. And you just wonder, like, if they hadn't been doing more things as a child, like, would they have sustained those injuries or not?
And just as a pediatrician, what is your sense about how parents are responding to this advice?
I think generally most are responsive. And I think that they want their child to be able to play long-term. Everybody hopes for that college scholarship. And I think that they realize that if their child gets injured early, the likelihood that they're going to, you know, be able to play again lifelong is going to be detrimental. And I think just in overall health, I think that they want their child to be able to play long-term. So for the most part, I think I've been seeing parents being very receptive of this and, you know, enrolling their kids in a bunch of different things, or if I'm like, hey, your kid doesn't need to be scheduled from the moment they get out of school until the moment they go to sleep at night, like, give them one thing to do. I think that they're responsive to that. I think we have a culture where busyness is celebrated. And I'm hoping that with this teaching, we can move that down a little bit and let kids and parents rest. You know, they don't need to be going from sunup to sundown.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Dr. Ashley Pence. She's medical director for pediatrics at University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And we're talking about the incident of the 6-year-old boy running the Flying Pig Marathon in Cincinnati earlier this month. There's been a lot of outcry from the running community. In fact, former Olympian Kara Goucher, former long distance Olympian Kara Goucher, said, quote, "A 6-year-old who is struggling physically does not realize that they have the right to stop and should." And just from a pediatrician's point of view, what do you understand and what should we understand about a child's agency in these decisions?
I think when you're teaching a kid to do any type of physical activity or sport, I think making sure that they're feeling the joy in it is one of the most important things. And making sure that they're not feeling like they're pressured into doing some of these things. Familial pressure can be very high to do something. And a lot of times kids don't always know when to stop. I mean, if you think about a tired toddler, like, you know, in their best interest, it's the best thing for the toddler to go to sleep, but the toddler fights and fights and fights, right? So a kid doesn't always know when it's the best thing to do for them to stop. And so as adults and as parents and pediatricians, it's one of our responsibilities to kind of encourage them. You know, we always listen to this philosophy of, you know, no pain, no gain, but I think pain should be like very much listened to of like, no, pain isn't something that should just be pushed through. It's our body telling us like we need to stop and rest and give our body a break.
The parents of the child, Ben and Cammie Crawford, they've said that it's a family thing that they do together and that the kid wants to be with family and that they have fun doing this. And it made me wonder, well, maybe they're doing something that the kid doesn't necessarily love. I mean, a marathon takes a long time. running long distance takes a lot of time, just time from a kid's life. And I thought maybe they are just doing it just to be with family. And is that a good reason to do something as challenging as a 21 point something mile run? Or 26 or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously family influence and family togetherness is extremely important. We know that, you know, families need to spend time together. So I think that's up to every family. I'm a true believer in that for the most part, families and parents think that they're doing the right thing by their children. With regardless with except for some very, you know, specific circumstances, but for the most part, they think they're doing the right thing. And so I can't speak for these parents or what they're thinking of and at this point, but I do think that, you know, a lot of families you see, like, dad plays baseball, so son will play baseball and everything like that. And so I think that this is, you know, probably their sense of family togetherness, and it's something that's important to them. And whether it was right or not by the child, I don't know that I can comment on, mm-hmm. but I think, again, most parents think that they're doing the right thing by their child.
Are we getting better at, in some ways, at protecting children when it comes to sports? You know, more helmets are being worn, better helmets, that kind of, you know, things. They limit, for instance, how many games or how many innings a kid can pitch in Little League to save their arm for the future, that kind of a thing. Or is it only coupled with more pressure to do more, you know, to focus more on sports?
I do think that we are getting better. Again, pitch counts, how many games you can play, safety gear. I do agree that that's important. I do think that we do put a lot of pressure on our kids. You know, in my generation, it was we're called the participation trophy generation. we're not that way anymore. Like, kids have to win now. So I think that that's a little bit more pressure for them than probably my generation was. And so I do worry about that a little bit, but I'm hoping, like, with more teaching of, like, this is a game, like, let's have fun and expressing the joy in the game. And I'm hoping coaches are getting better about that too. You know, Williamsport, where I practice, is the home of the Little League World Series. And before every Little League game, they do the Little League oath, which is that we find joy in our game and that we respect our opponents and we respect our coaches. And I'm hoping that, like, we continue to bring that to each and every game that we bring out there for our kids and instill that in our children.
Well, you work with athletes participating in Little League Baseball. Is it because of where you're located? It's because of that?
Yeah. It is. I'm not a big sport person. I was never a baseball person, but when you live and work in Williamsport, you become a baseball person because you don't really have any other choice. And I will tell you, every year when Little League World Series is here, you are every child's biggest fan that is out on that field, because it's just a wonderful atmosphere to be involved in. The kids are so lovely. They want to win, they want to play, but they want to have fun too. And the coaches are awesome. Like, we have so many volunteers who put so much time and effort into this that it's a great atmosphere.
Yeah. Are there any signals you think parents can take from coaches that suggest that maybe they're pushing the kids too hard, or should they questions the parents should ask coaches about how they manage a team?
Yeah, I think that, you know, anytime you see a kid who's getting overly stressed out, if the kid is like, I don't ever want to go back there, I don't want to do that anymore, I think it's a time for a parent to have a conversation with the coach of what's going on. Why is my kid not enjoying this? Again, kids should be feeling joy when they're participating in an activity. And so I would hope that parents would have that conversation with the coach about, like, what's going on? What can we do better? Or maybe that's just not the sport for them. Like, we need to find something else. And just being open and honest and not forcing a kid to play a sport that maybe that they just are not finding joy in.
Ultimately, who is responsible? Parents, physicians, race coordinators, that kind of a thing, coaches? Where does it fall? Is it all on the head of the parents?
I think it has to be a team approach. You know, I think coaches have to make sure that a kid is enjoying what they're doing. Parents have to talk to their kid, like, you know, every night, like, how was your game? Like, not just like superficial questions, but do you enjoy what you're doing? And just making sure that our kids are finding joy in what they're doing. I know I keep saying that over and over again, but I think joy is such a thing that kids should be feeling when they're participating in activities.
When you heard about this 6-year-old running in this marathon in Cincinnati, what did you think?
I had heard about it and I was like, oh, well, that's interesting. But I think it's kind of one of those things, like, we hear about these feats of children all the time that is extraordinary, but not average, you know? Like, we've heard about teenagers who climb Mount Everest. I actually used this example with the nurse practitioner that works with me in the office this morning. We hear about, you know, certain feats all the time that are extraordinary, but again, not average. And I think that we need to, like, set expectations that not every child is going to be able to do this, and not every child should do this either. I'm hoping that these parents like run with this kid, and if parents are going to enroll their child in a running race, that they have trained with them and worked with them before putting them in something like this.
What about the fact that the kid was underage for the race? What kind of message is that parent sending the kid on that score and sneaking them in?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a rule follower, so I think that, again, that falls on both the parents and the race coordinators of how did that happen. Mm-hmm. So again, I think that should be looked into, but again, that would fall on parents and the race coordinator of how that happened.
I'm curious as well about the age requirement for the Flying Pig Marathon. It's 18, and what your thoughts are about age requirements in general. I mean, is it a science or an art?
So it's a little bit of both. I actually, before I did this interview, I did a quick research. So there's actually mileage recommendations for kids based on their age. And the marathon is about 18 years old. A half marathon is about 14 to 15 years old. Up until 9, they're recommending about a mile and a half in a single distance. So, you know, there, and again, that has to do with, you know, developmental maturity of bones and muscles and ligaments and everything like that. And again, trying to prevent those overuse injuries.
And as far as training, how does training work for a child depending on the sport?
So for running, it's basically, you know, miles wise, they should never be running more than like twice the number of miles that they would do for a race per week. They should not be running vigorously every single day. They should obviously have days off. There should be stretch days in between. And then for other sports, it's the same thing. Like they should have days off. They should have seasons off. They shouldn't be playing year round. And there should be a lot of conditioning to go along with it. So stretching, endurance building. So just, you know, getting up your endurance by running, walking, those kind of things. Again, you don't want to focus on just like a pitcher just throwing pitches. You want to make sure that they are training in other areas so that we're not developing those overuse injuries.
And just going back to the what we talked about at the very top, you said 60 minutes of moderate, vigorous exercise every day. Can you talk about some examples of what that would involve? Because some people just don't know.
Yeah, so moderately vigorous activity is basically your heart rate is up, but you're able to still speak in full sentences. So everybody thinks, oh, I need to like put my kid on a treadmill and have them run or walk at a fast pace. I hate running on treadmills. I think that's awful. And that's boring. Nobody wants to do that. So I give examples of like having a dance party in your living room can be moderately vigorous activity if you're dancing hard enough. Running around playing tag in short bursts. You know, if you go sledding in the winter, walking your sled back up the hill, all of those kind of things that, again, you're finding ways to make it fun. And when we say 60 minutes, it doesn't have to be 60 straight minutes. It can be broken up into 10 to 15 minute blocks based on attention span and just endurance in general. You just want it kind of cumulative over the course of the day that they're getting this activity in.
Are you worried about younger people using boosters for exercise, or I mean, to improve their physicality, hormones, that kind of a thing?
I do at times. Thankfully, in this generation, I haven't seen it a lot.
Okay.
What I worry more about is these new things like pre-workouts and energy drinks. Some of those things can have some pretty detrimental effects on kids, and so I'm usually recommending against them. And, you know, wait till you're older if you want to use those things. So I caution people to be very careful about them.
And, you know, the child that ran in the marathon, you said it's not average. It is extraordinary, but it's not average. You know, there are kids out there, as we know, that are super ambitious, and they want, you know, and what do you tell a child when you say, no, you really need to rest every other day or whatever? How can you explain to them what's happening in their body and why that's important?
So I try to explain, it's hard to explain in layman's terms, but we try. We try to explain about how their body is maturing. I have a lot of kids who play football who like to weightlift, especially at younger ages. And weightlifting is great. We want them to weightlift, but we also want them to be careful about it. And so we say you need to take a break on those, on the days that you break. It doesn't mean you have to be sedentary. Do yoga. Everybody laughs at yoga, but yoga is actually wonderful for you. It helps strengthen your muscles in a different way. It helps lengthen your muscles to give you better results over time. So you don't have to be sedentary on those days. You're still working towards your goal that you want. You're just doing it in a different way. So I have a lot of kids that are super motivated to succeed. And I try to explain to them. And sometimes I'm very blunt with them. Like, if you keep doing this, you're going to hurt yourself and then you're going to be out. And then I'm not going to be able to let you play. And I'm blunt with them, especially as they get older. And most of the time you can scare them without using scaring them. into taking a break so that they don't get hurt.
What are you seeing? You said you're not seeing in this generation right now, using substances to improve their performance. But what are you seeing in the physical therapy room? How are kids, are they getting hurt more, or are we stabilizing on that score, or what?
I think we're doing a pretty good job overall. I do think we do still have quite a few injuries. Again, I think, kids want to succeed. We live in a society where everybody's pushed to succeed and pushed to do well. And so with that comes injuries. And for the most part, I think kids are bouncing back. And I think as a medical community, we're probably better at recognizing it and getting them the treatment that they need a little bit quicker. And also being super cautious with it too. If you think about concussions, we're better at recognizing and treating concussions than we ever have been before, and cautious about concussions. So I think that we're getting better at it. Because again, from that standpoint, it is the adult's responsibility to be taken care of from that standpoint.
You know, I've always questioned the reporting ability of children, particularly when it comes to concussions in particular, but kind of almost anything. I remember my kid had water on his hip and he was limping, and I finally noticed he was limping, and I said, "You're limping." And he's like, "Yeah, I know." I'm like, "Well, why are you limping?" He goes, "I don't really know." And he was, like 6 years old. I worry about their ability to discern and distinguish properly and be good reporters about their wellness and their well-being.
Yeah, I do too. So anytime I know a kid is involved in sports, I have a good discussion with them of, "Hey, bud, like, if you're hurting, you need to tell mom, you need to tell dad so they can let me know so that we can help you." I think that's the biggest thing. A lot of kids don't want to, they feel like they're going to get in trouble, or they are worried about being removed from their sports because of an injury or something. And so I just kind of push it and say, "Hey, we really need to make sure that you tell me if something's hurting." I think if we're open and frank with our kids from early on to report their injuries, then we do better in the long run. And especially with concussions, of when they're playing football or anything that's high contact, I'm like, if you get hit in the head, you need to stop and you need to tell us, because brains are our most important organ. We need to take care of those. So,
But they want to get put back in. They don't want to. Yeah,
they do. And again, it's that blunt discussion I have with them, especially as they get older. If you hurt yourself now and we can't fix it, then your likelihood to play long term is going to be gone. So we need to take care of you now.
Dr. Pence, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ashley Pence is the medical director for pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. We've been talking to her about kids and athletics after word broke that a 6-year-old boy finished the Flying Pig Marathon in Cincinnati earlier this month. That's it for Wellness Wednesday. Thanks so much for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.